Indeed, the Maharshi often referred to the story of King Janaka, who, on attaining realization, exclaimed, "Now I have caught the thief who had been robbing me all these years. Why do I thus misplace my eye sense? Because I take sense perceptions for true. I have to learn to realize the true I, which underlies mind and senses and the whole objective world. Man's mind and senses are used to cognize objective things. But this talent is of no use for knowing the self, in which there is no trace of objectivity. One cannot have a vision of the self or know the self as one knows another, because that would imply two selves in you, one to know the other." Quote, "You speak of a vision of Shiva, but a vision always presumes an object. That implies the existence of a subject. The value of the vision is the same as that of the seer. That is to say, the nature of the vision is on the same plane as that of the seer." Unquote. Unquote. "A vision of God is only a vision of the self objectified as the God of your particular faith. What you have to do is to know the self." Unquote. "And to know the self is only to know, to be aware, to be." A devotee asks, "When I seek the I see nothing." Bhagavan, you say that because you are accustomed to identifying yourself with the body and the sight with the eyes. But what is there to be seen? And by whom? And how? There's only one consciousness, and this, when it identifies itself with the body, projects itself through the eyes and sees the surrounding objects. The individual is limited to the waking state. He expects to see something different and accepts the authority of the senses. He will not admit that he who sees, the object seen, and the act of seeing are all manifestations of the same consciousness, the I. Self-inquiry helps to overcome the illusion that the self is something to see. How do you recognize yourself now? Do you have to hold a mirror in front of yourself and to recognize yourself? The awareness is itself the I. Realize it, and that is the truth. However, the ego is engrossed with seeing, hearing, feeling, and objective knowing. It values these functions and considers them as belonging to the self. Blinded by this view, one does not experience the brilliance of the true I. One's attention is to be drawn away from such objective perceptions to that which, with respect to which there is unknowingness. If that were known and experienced as it is, it would be recognized as one's very self. And then the false I would fade out. The outer man is unreal and should be made passive, a mere recipient of impressions. Self-inquiry helps to do this. The journey is inwards, though territory unknown to the senses. So long as life remains, one should strive to reach one's source. This is the only worthy aim in life, the only goal worth seeking, the only use of life that can be put an end to suffering and frustration and reveal the pure bliss, the radiant consciousness, the unruffled being that one really is. the weapon for doing this on the Maharshi's path is concentration on the I sense. This is not like other thoughts that come and go and can be dismissed at will. One's attention must be constantly drawn to feeling of pure awareness, pure consciousness of I am-ness. At first, this can be done only during concentrated sessions of self-inquiry, known loosely as meditation. But later, the awareness of I am-ness becomes an undercurrent underlying all one's activities. This I sense is the scent, by tracing which, to its source, one reaches the self, as a dog tracks out its master. Am I worse than a dog? Steadfastly will I track thee out and regain thee, O Arunachala. First of the five hymns to Arunachala, verse 39. The Maharshi says that if one earnestly seeks the I, the false I vanishes, leaving only the true to shine in all its pristine glory. His teaching is based on his own experience, not on learning or reasoning. And nothing he says is for the sake of argument. What can be more heartening to the traveler on the mountain path? Okay, here's a quote from Taito Manavar. When the ego sense of the individual, me, vanishes, there springs up within me an endless current of I, conferring unique and transcendental bliss, which engulfs all my knowledge and ends in silence. How then can silence be expressed? And a quote from Shankara, it is only because of ignorance that the self appears to be finite. When ignorance is destroyed, the self, which does not admit of any multiplicity whatsoever, truly reveals itself by itself, like the sun when the cloud is removed. And the quote from Ramana Maharshi from the 40 Verses on Reality, although the scriptures proclaim, thou art that, it is only a sign of weakness of mind to meditate, I am that, not this, because you are eternally that. What has to be done is to investigate what one really is and remain that. The Sufism, Islamic. The question. They believe like Sufism. It came before Islam. Mm-hmm. You know, heard this argument. Okay, here's an aggressive teacher by Sagittarius. Sagittarius is Arthur Ashmore. Synonym.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Christ was an aggressive teacher. Verbally, he hit back hard when attacked. No, quote, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, unquote, about him. His method was always to counterattack and put the attacker on the defense. When Buddha came to a rest house with a few followers one night and heard a sadhu there holding forth against him and his teaching, he neither intervened nor allowed his followers to. This magnanimity had such an effect that the attacker became a follower. When abused, he answered mildly that since he refused to accept the abuse, it must fall back on the utterer. When, on the other hand, to take one characteristic example among many, some Pharisees asked Jesus, why his disciples ate without the prescribed ritualistic washing of hands. He rounded on them, calling them hypocrites, quoting Isaiah against them and adding, "You are so busy holding on to the traditions of men that you let go the commandment of God." Footnote. In these articles, my quotations from the Gospels will normally be taken from the translation of J.B. Phillips, The Gospel in Modern English. Okay. True, of course, but certainly the way to make enemies. Once when he was accusing some Pharisees of hypocrisy, a doctor of law protested, "Master, when you say things like that, you are insulting us as well." And he returned, "Yes, and I do blame you, experts in law, for you pile up back-breaking burdens for other men to bear, but you yourself will not raise a finger to lift them. Alas for you, for your build memorial tombs for the prophets, the very men whom your fathers murdered. You show clearly enough how to approve of your fathers' actions. They did the actual killing, and you put up the memorial to it." Many of the lawyers may have deserved rebuke for being formalists. Many lawyers do in all ages, but they could hardly help being antagonized by such an onslaught. Many of the Pharisees may have been hypocrites, but we know from surviving Jewish accounts that some at least of them were men of integrity and devotion, sincerely trying to perpetuate all that was best in the Jewish tradition. Moreover, Christ saying that all who were not for him were against him implied that they were deliberately being treated as enemies. To recognize the new teaching and teacher must have required such integrity and understanding that there were bound to be quite a number who did not, priests, lawyers, ordinary people, and a wholesale denunciation of them seems unnecessarily aggressive to those steeped in any Eastern tradition. Buddha rejected the Brahmin monopoly of wisdom as family, as Christ did that of the Pharisees, but he never denounced them. He simply accepted non-Brahmins into his order on the same footing as Brahmins. Another striking feature is that Jesus constantly demanded belief not only in his teaching, but in himself, and denounced those who did not believe in him. Quote, "The difference between us is that you come from below and I from above. You belong to this world, but I do not. That is why I told you, you will die in your sins. For unless you believe that I am who I am, you will die in your sins." Unquote. There's a similar emphasis in Islam. The Quran is full of assertions that Muhammad is the true prophet and denunciation of those who do not recognize him as such. In both cases, the assertion may have been true, the denunciation justified. But apart from the truth of a teaching, there is a manner in which it is delivered to be considered. The former might be called vertical, the descent from formless truth to the forms of a human world, the latter to horizontal, the permeation of the human world. Okay. This is a poem called "Beacon, A Beacon Still" by S.P. Mukherjee. The author explains that "we" is used instead of "I" in order to include his wife, who settled now near Raman Ashraman with him after the death of the Maharshi. I met this person, S.P. Mukherjee. "We have not seen you, Bhagavan. We have not approached your lotus feet. Yet do we find the now and the then are the same for us. The body presence, the presence in the heart, these are the same. One thing only do we know, the Ramanashram is a beacon still. Quote from the teaching of, from the Zen teaching of Yangpo. Your true nature is something never lost to you, even in moments of delusion, nor is it gained at the moment of enlightenment. In it is neither delusion nor right understanding. It fills the void everywhere and is intrinsically of the substance of the one mind. And Tukaram said, I give birth to myself. I was conceived within my own body. Now all vows are fulfilled. All desire is extinguished. I have become well and strong. I died away that time. I look on both sides. Tukha is what he is. And from Shankara's commentary on the Taittiriya Upanishad, the purpose of Atma-jnana is to remove the illusory self created by avidya, ignorance. The attainment of self by divine knowledge means only the removal of the illusory self created by ignorance through the superimposition of the body as the self. A visit to Ananda Ashram in the lifetime of Swami Ramdas by Una Mulai. Some friends were going to Ananda Ashram by car. And you know this Ananda Ashram, Kanadgad.
Kerala.
Of Kerala, right?
Kerala.
You have seen that? You have been
no,
there?
No, it still exists. Ananda Ashram is still there.
Of course, yeah. After Mother Krishna Bhai died, then the Swami Satchitananda,
yes.
I've seen him. He had come to the ashram. Every year in Jayanti, they send big box of these banana chips. Banana.
Oh, okay, Kerala.
They've been doing it since Bhagavan's time, and they still do.
Okay.
You know, he came, Papa Ram Das came to Bhagavan. And went into ecstasy and went up on the hill.
Started embracing the trees.
Yeah, it's a funny story. You know, he saw, then he realized everything is Ram. You know, and then he came out of the cave, saw some woodcutter, and he went to embrace him, and he started running from him, and he started running. He started running after him, and he said, "Look at Ram has no teeth. I won't hurt you. Come." Because his teeth were all gone. You know.
Yeah.
He was all became like a madman. Some friends were going to Ananda Ashram by car, and having heard Swami Ram Das for years past, but never yet visited him. He died in 1963. That's the year before this was published. I accepted their invitation to accompany them. In fact, he was the only living saint whom I had an inclination to see. As it turned out, you know, he came to New York City. Mm-hmm. They even walked all through Macy's.
Oh, really?
Wow. Biggest store in the world at that time.
I didn't know that. It still is the biggest store in the world, I think.
I don't know. In fact, he was the only living saint whom I had an inclination to see. As it turned out, it was very fortunate that I took this opportunity because only a few months later he died suddenly, quite unexpectedly. While the car was approaching Ananda Ashram, after a long drive through undulating wooded country, and was still about 2 miles away, I suddenly had the extraordinary experience of hearing the invocation of Ram everywhere. The earth, the trees, the humming of the car, the sound of the wind, all were vibrating with the name of Ram. This was all the more remarkable as I had never been drawn to this invocation and had never used it. Later, I understood why it was so. The first thing that struck me on beholding Swami Ram Das, affectionately called Papa by everyone, was how much nicer he looked in real life than on photos. His face was beaming with joyfulness, goodness, liveliness. His smile was so childlike and spontaneous that one felt immediately drawn to him. I found that the ashram was being run by Mother Krishnabai, known to everybody as Mataji. When we went from the car straight to the Swami's room, tired and unwashed, she was there. I had met her once before, briefly years ago, when she was passing through Madras. She was young then and in good health, but somehow the meeting had left no impression. But now I saw before me a face ravished by sickness yet incredibly beautiful, with a beauty not of this world. She is worshipped as a realized soul. We were received very kindly and shown to our rooms, which were comfortable and airy. After washing and changing into a white sari, I went back to Papa's room. A number of people were there, sitting on the floor, ladies against the wall, and men at the other side, with Papa in his armchair, his feet resting on a footstool. People kept coming and prostrating before him and touching his feet. He explained that a current of power flows through a saint and that there is a special benefit from touching his feet. That is why so many of the sacred poems and songs refer to the lotus feet of the Guru. In his presence, one felt enveloped in an atmosphere of love and joyfulness. At 7:30, the bell rang for the evening meal, and we all went to the adjoining building, in which were the dining hall and kitchen. Food was served on stainless steel plates on the floor, in two rows, one for women and one for men. While we waited to be served, the dining hall was resounding with the chanting of Ram Nam. Outstanding was the soprano of a Norwegian-trained opera singer and the powerful deep voice of a German. The food was purely vegetarian, excellent in quality, and with due consideration for those who could not eat spiced food. One could feel the loving care of Mataji behind it. You know, they have Ram Nam recited 24 hours. They do it continually there.
Yeah,
they take turns. You know, they have groups to it. After the meal, we assembled in the main hall where Papa was already seated. People asked questions, and he not only gave replies and upadesha, but launched into reminiscences of his own sadhana during the years when he was a wandering sadhu. He wrote that on these books, you know, The World is God. Beautiful stories. How he used to, you know, travel around as a sadhu.
He lived in caves and faced mountain lions and things like that.
Yeah.
He's really... He lived a very exciting life. He was not just sweet Papa, he was like a wild man.
Where was he originally from, Dennis?
I think it's Maharashtrian.
Maharashtrian,
yeah. Although most of these can be found in his books, it was quite a different experience to hear him telling them, sometimes poignant, sometimes full of laughter. At 10 o'clock, all took leave of Papa and Mataji and went to their rooms, except a few who just spread their bedding and laid down to sleep in the hall. At 5 in the morning, some of the devotees went to Papa's room and sat in silent meditation for about an hour until 6, when he got up. This morning hour seems to have been the only time for silent meditation. During the day, it was much more talking and asking questions. The chanting of the mantra went on almost uninterruptedly in the big hall, except when Papa sat there with the devotees, as he usually did after lunch and dinner. As I said, the atmosphere was very lively when he began his exposition with reminiscences. Once I was deeply moved when he told about his experience as a sadhu at a railway station. How cold it was, and a policeman came and told him to get up and go somewhere else. But at first he couldn't because his legs were numb and swollen from sitting in the cold. With a voice choked with emotion, I asked, "And then?" He immediately saw what I felt and said reassuringly, "It was all right afterwards. Ram took good care of Ramdas, and some friends looked after him." He always did refer to himself in this way, in the third person, as Ramdas, meaning slave of Ram. There was the spontaneity of a child in him, a carefree, happy child. When the mail came in the afternoon, he would read the letters out with childlike zest, even if they were private. It was bhakti at its purest, though at the same time he sometimes spoke pure Advaita. Of course, ultimately, bhakti and jnana merge. There cannot be love without wisdom, or wisdom without love. When Papa left, which was very often, he used to bring on prolonged bouts of coughing, ending in breathlessness. So he would laugh and then start coughing and out of breath. I suppose everybody stopped laughing when he started coughing. Everybody probably started laughing, but then he started coughing and put his very silent. I was very concerned about this and had a strong foreboding. This proved only too justified a few months later when he suddenly expired in a fit of suffocation, as we were told by an eyewitness. How the devotees must have missed him. However, Mataji is still there. We used to correspond with her in the 70s, in Nova Scotia. While I was there, she was running the ashram firmly but unobtrusively and with loving care. What struck me was her great modesty and genuine spirit of loving service, which she managed to instill into those around her. Ill as she was, one would see her folding the laundry of the visitors and doing endless jobs, big and small. Finally, something about Ram Nam, which was the very essence of the teaching of Ramdas. People were singing it, repeating it silently, writing it out for hours together. Its purpose is to hold the mind to one thought so as to prevent its wandering. Mantras are not my way, but Papa explained that even following some other way, the mantra can be used as a fan to make the flame burn brighter. A strange thing happened in this connection. It must have been about the time that Swami Ramdas expired, about which we were heard only several days later. I was making the pilgrimage around Arunachala. My mind was unsteady. So I remembered the mantra and what Papa had said about it and used it as a fan. At that moment, it came to life for me. It was Papa himself merged in the mantra. There was that indescribable feeling of tenderness, nearness, all the goodness. He was there, all-pervading. Papa lives on in the mantra. Here's a nice, very learned article, Relation Between Religion and Art. He gives poems and everything. By Arthur Osborne. Here's a quote from Shankara's commentary on the Brahma Sutras. The Vedantic text teaches that although Brahman is one, he is regarded both as possessing attributes and as free from them. In the former sense, he is the object of meditation, in the latter, of knowledge. And Tukaram says, my death is dead and gone. I have been made immortal. All sense of body is wiped out, root and branch. The deluge came and went. I clung to life with courage. Tuka says, the foundations have been truly disclosed.
Maharashtra produced a lot of saints.
Yeah.
Jagannath, Tukaram. And still they do the same thing. To Pandharpur Yatra, they come in palanquins and just as they were doing in the olden days.
Mm.
Still there.
Ashram Bulletin, 1964. On Friday, April 14, 1950, the doctors in attendance knew it was the last day. In the morning, he again bade them go and meditate. About noon, when liquid food was brought for him, he asked the time, punctual as ever, but then added, but henceforth, time doesn't matter. Delicately expressing recognition of their long years of service, he said to the attendants, the English have a word, thanks, but we only say santosham. I am pleased. In the morning, the long crowd filed past the open doorway, silent with grief and apprehension. And again between 4 and 5 in the evening, the disease-racked body they saw there was shrunken, the ribs protruding, the skin blackened. It was a pitiable vestige of pain. And yet at some time during these last few days, each devotee received a direct, luminous, penetrating look of recognition, which he felt as a parting infusion of grace. After darshan that evening, the devotees did not disperse to their homes. Apprehension held them there. At about sunset, Sri Bhagavan told the attendants to sit him up. They knew already that every movement, every touch was painful, but he told them not to worry about that. He sat with one of the attendants supporting his head. A doctor began to give him oxygen. But with a wave of his right hand, he motioned him away. There were about a dozen persons in the small room, doctors in attendance. Two of the attendants were fanning him, and the devotees outside gazed spellbound at the moving fans through the window, a sign that there was still a living body to fan. A reporter of a large American magazine moved about restlessly, uneasy at having been impressed despite himself, and determined not to write his story till he got away from Tiruvannamalai to conditions that are considered normal. With him was a French press photographer, Cartier Prasant. And that journalist, he wrote an article for the New Yorker, I Saw a God Die. And Daryl Berrigan, I think his name was. But he was stationed in Malaysia. Unexpectedly, a group of devotees sitting on the veranda outside the hall began singing Arunachala Shiva, Arunachala Shiva. On hearing it, Sri Bhagavan's eyes opened and shone. He gave a brief smile of indescribable tenderness. From the outer edges of his eyes, tears of bliss rolled down. One more breath, one more deep breath and no more. There was no struggling, no struggle, no spasm, no other sign of death, only that the next breath did not come. For a few moments, people stood bewildered. The singing continued. The French press photographer came up to me, the editor, this is Arthur Osborne's writing, and asked, what precise minute did that happen? Resenting it as journalistic callousness, I replied brusquely that I did not know. And then I suddenly recalled Sri Bhagavan's unfailing courtesy and answered precisely that it was 8:47 p.m. He said, and I could hear now that he was excited, that he had been pacing the road outside, and at that very moment an enormous star had trailed slowly across the sky. Many had seen it, even as far as Madras, and felt what it portended. It passed to the northeast towards the peak of Arunachala. After the first numbness, there was a wild burst of grief. The body was carried out on the veranda in a sitting posture. Men and women crowded up to the veranda, railing to see. A woman fainted. Others sobbed aloud. The body was placed garlanded upon a couch in the hall, and the devotees thronged there and sat around it. One had expected the face to be rock-like in samadhi, but found it instead so marked by pain that it gripped one's heart. Only gradually during the night, the air of mysterious composure returned to it. All that night, devotees sat in the large hall, and townsfolk passed through in awed silence. Processions streamed from the town and back singing Arunachala Shiva. Some of the devotees in the hall sang songs of praise and grief. Others sat silent. What was most noticeable was not the grief, but the calm beneath it. For they were men and women deprived of him whose grace had been the very meaning of their life. Already that first night, and much more during the days that followed, it became clear how vital had been his words. I am not going away. Where could I go? I am here. The word here does not imply any limitation, but rather that the self is, that there is no going, no changing for that which is universal. Nevertheless, as devotees felt the inner presence of Bhagavan, and as they felt the continued divine presence at Tiruvannamalai, they began to regard it as a promise full of love and solicitude. During the night of the vigil, a decision had to be taken as to the burial. It had been thought that the body might be interred in the new hall, but many devotees opposed the idea. They felt that the hall was, in a sense, an adjunct to the temple and would make the shrine of Sri Bhagavan seem subordinate to that of the mother, reversing the true order of things. Next day, by general agreement, a pit was dug and the body interred with divine honors in the space between the old hall and the temple. The crowd, packed tight, looked on in silent grief. No more the beloved face, no more the sound of his voice. Henceforth, the lingam of polished black stone, the symbol of Shiva, over the tomb was the outer sign, and inwardly his footprints in the heart. Continued presence, the crowd dispersed. All right, finish this tomorrow. This is taken right from the book, you know, where she has a self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So, There's a whole thing. This is the first issue. He's giving the shrine and the ashram, the management organization, kind of an analytic.
Oh, that's still the first issue.
Yeah.
He had lots of articles in it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite thick, right?
Well, this is four issues.
Oh, okay. So, voila, well, I see Asha here.
She has to go to work.
Yeah.
So, three, about me, you, Diljit says he's going. I don't know about Gita. Did she say anything?
She said she would come, but I'll check with her.
Yeah, so maybe Gita. So maybe five of us.
Margo's not going?
No.
Margo, you've never ridden in my car.
It's quite the experience, Margo.
Yes, I'm sure.
You shouldn't pass it out.
What is it?